Hello everyone, podcasting him softly, this is Kent Hill back again, and my guest today, very special guest, is a very esteemed screenwriter. He's the writer of Zeus and Roxanne, The Adventures of Pinocchio, and an 80s gem, the 80s gem film that I know and love, I'm sure a lot of people know and love, is Cocoon. My guest, Tom Benedict. Tom, thank you for being on podcasting him softly.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you. Thanks for the kind words. I try and stay relevant, but keeping busy and doing some interesting stuff. And Cocoon was, magic in its time. It was a wonderful film to have worked on. And it amazes me that it's had this kind of resilience that people remember it.
Yeah. Lightning in a bottle. But anyway, before we get to Cocoon, as I often do, I know about you, but I always take into account there's people listening that may not. So, before we touch on Cocoon, if you could talk a little bit about how you came to, obviously your love of films, you learning the craft, your journey up until Cocoon, if you will.
Okay, I always loved movies. My parents, my mom loved movies. We used to go to the movies every Friday night, and she was a fan, and I just always really liked it. We had a neighbor, one of my mom's best friends is a woman, Jackie Balaban, and her husband, Bert Balaban, was a producer and a filmmaker, and so he had us on the set with one of his movies, and he just got me really excited about movies. And his father was a guy named Barney Balaban, who had been the president of Paramount. And he came from a show business family, and they went out to California, and he stayed in New York and was kind of a New York independent feature filmmaker. The most famous movie he did was Murder Incorporated. And it was like, I think it was the screen debut of, Peter Falk.
Right.
And my Brit was in the movie, who had been married to Sammy Davis Jr. So we were on the set of that movie. We had a picture taken with my Brit and Peter Falk.
Awesome.
My brother and I.
Awesome.
I saw that picture. So I started that, and then I went to, when I was in undergrad, I started making little films and doing photography, and I did my junior year abroad in Paris and went to this independent film school. It was during time when they were right after the days of May in Paris, a political time in France, and I was very interested in foreign films and the new wave films, so trying to European cinema at that time. So I went to film school and there at this place and spent a lot of time at the cinema tech and saw many, many, many films at that time, just steeped myself in the history of cinema. And then when I finished school, sort of the golden age of the original screenplay, Francis Ford Coppola had broken into Hollywood by being a writer. So I started writing scripts. I had done some journalism in high school, and I had written plays and stuff like that in high school. And so I started writing screenplays, and I went out to California, and I just wrote 10 scripts over a period of years. And I had like little jobs here and there, non-guild jobs. And then I was, by some great fortune, I ended up in a situation where I was offered Cocoon.
Wow.
I could tell you that story, the narrative, how that happened, if you want to hear that.
That'd be fantastic. That was my next sort of section. Yeah.
Okay. My brother was a lawyer, and he represented Larry Kasdan. And Larry Kasdan is doing Raiders of the Lost Ark. He'd done Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Empire Strikes Back. And my brother was his attorney for a long time before that. And so I wrote a script called Orange County Red, which is it was a thriller about a Russian spy in deep cover in Orange County, sort of like a notorious kind of thing. Hitchcock film. And my brother liked that script, and he gave it to Larry Kasdan, and Kasdan liked it too, which is and he gave it to Bob Zemeckis to read. And Bob Zemeckis said, I want to make this movie. So he ran around town trying to set up my script, and I thought, wow, this is going to be great. I'm going to get, you know, have this movie made with Bob. And it seemed like I was, after years of trying to get something going in Hollywood, I was going to have something, you know, in the Golden Circle there. We couldn't set it up. He was sort of unemployable at that time because he had done two movies with Spielberg. I Want to Hold Your Hand, these great movies, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and Used Cars. And then the next movie that he did was, Spielberg directed 1941.
Right.
And so after, none of those movies did well at the box office. And so it was really hard for Bob to get anything going. So, you know, that kind of died away. And then about 6 months later, the phone rang, and it was Bob, and he said, I have this project at Fox. Would you be interested in working on it? And I was like, you know, of course. And so that was a rewrite of an adaptation of an unpublished novel that he had with Zach Brown. And he was supposed to direct it, and it was Cocoon. So I, you know, had to, I read what they had. They had a draft that had been written by another writer who had adapted it, and it did work well.
So was that David Saperstein? He's the other.
No, David Saperstein was the author of the unpublished novel.
Oh, okay, he was the author. Okay,
that was working from.
Right, yeah. So there was
and
another.
Richard Zanuck twice really had found this manuscript and fell in love with the story, and they had Roscoe Pallenberg, who's a wonderful writer. Who worked with John Borman a lot.
Right.
And he did the Emerald Forest and a couple of other movies with him, I think. And he had done the first adaptation before Zemeckis got involved.
Okay.
And then they, you know, it didn't, that sort of, that development phase was completed. And the draft was, they weren't happy with the draft they had. So I had to take what they had, and I kind of just sort of reinvented the wheel, tried to figure it out in terms of, like, Bob, you know, how I envisioned this thing as something that would be great for Bob, you know, that would fit his, you know, his talents and his sensibilities.
Right.
So I retooled the story and what it was, and kept the essence of it, but reimagined it in a bunch of ways, and then pitched it to Zanuck and Brown, and they liked it, you know, so they hired me to do this adaptation, you know, so I did
right.
that. And,
So to jump in there, like, this was an unpublished book, and like you said, there was already a draft. So what sort of great, you know, you said, like, reinventing the wheel, like, what were sort of the big changes to the story that you came in with?
I changed the character. I worked a lot on the characters of the retirees.
Right, right.
And, they're sort of like the ensemble of the retirees and what their relationships were.
Right.
And the sensory experience that they were having with the treatments with what the extraterrestrials were doing
right.
to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of like, I made it more like, I reframed it. Instead of being in Miami in the exercise room of a condominium complex,
right,
I changed it to a much more sort of it was a retirement community, you know, sort of pastoral retirement community with husband, and it was a and the way that they were introduced to the extraterrestrials. And the sensibility of the extraterrestrials and what the motivation of the extraterrestrials, what they were doing, and just kind of like tempered all those things.
Right.
So it was more of a fairy tale in a way, you know,
right.
more of like a, you know, so it was more, and envision what the aging was, you know, that the aging wasn't something where they looked young,
right.
but the aging was something which was internal.
Right.
And so using that internal, you know, youth idea, rather than external, you know, cosmetic euphoria.
Oh, okay.
And trying to, and then evolving that further in terms of like the feelings of, you know, sort of that there was this transcendent experience that people could have in the pool.
Right.
You know, Steve Gutenberg character has, you know, this relationship with the extraterrestrial, and that whole thing is mine. And there's just, you know, it was just different. And, it, you know, it was Savage Dean's story and the mythology of it and, you know, the idea, you know, I used all that, you know, and it's hard to know where one thing begins and the other ends.
Yeah.
I, you know,
did you get to read the unpublished manuscript?
Yeah, it was adapted from the unpublished, because it was unpublished, it was a quirky thing, because I thought I was writing an adaptation.
Right.
But the rules of the guild at that time were that if a piece of literary material has not been published, then it's a story. It could be 1,000 pages, because that was not a short story, it was a long book, it was a book,
yeah.
You know, it was a manuscript, but it was sort of unwieldy at that point.
Right. And Zanuck and Brown sort of had a little bit of a history of doing that sort of thing, because, I mean, they picked up Jaws before it was published too, didn't they?
Yeah. David Brown was in New York, you know, he was New York-based, and he had relationships with all the book agents, and, you know, he went to the Four Seasons for lunch every day, and that's where, you know, the book agents were, and that was his scene, you know, he was a New York guy, and so he, you know, was, you know, tapped out. We found these kinds of things a lot. And they worked very successfully from books a lot.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's kind of fascinating. So originally, when they started encountering, you know, with the de-aging thing, was literally a physical de-aging, was it? Like you saw them becoming younger or something, was it? Is that what I understand, or...?
Well, that they weren't becoming younger, you know, if it's about the mythology of the Fountain of Youth, generally, like, you know, you drink the water, so you know, you go into the Fountain of Youth, and then you look young, you know, you no longer are 65, you look 30 or 20 or something.
Okay, right.
And so it's like, but the idea of the film is that they'll live forever, but they're not going to get younger.
So that
was kind of the... So that made it, you know, certain that it was a film about, you know, about the people, you know, about the elderly, it had a component about the elderly, about aging.
Yeah. It's a great sort of, what I like about it is it's a science fiction movie without really being, you know, a heavy-handed science fiction movie, because it's a parallel story. It's really about people, and it's about the search for, you know, what keeps us vital, you know, because, I mean, we should talk about the cast, a great cast. I mean, like, Don Ameche, Wilford Brimley, Hume Cronin, Brian Dennehy, Jack Guilford, Steve Guttenberg, Maureen Stapleton, Jessica Tandy, Linda Harrison, Barrett Oliver, who was like the Haley Joel Osment of his time, Tani Welsh. I mean, what a cast. I mean, particularly for, you know, in an age where... In an age where everything old is new again in a remake, I really couldn't see Cocoon. I mean, I'm sure they could do it. Monday morning quarterbacking's always, you know, something that they do in Hollywood. But I really couldn't see a cast of mature actors being assembled of that quality if they ever decided to reboot the thing.
Yeah, no, it was a dream cast. It was great. And, you know, Ron Howard was a great director, and, you know, and Zanuck and David Brown, they really, you know, they worked hard to get.
Yeah. But, so I know that there's writers that aren't present during filming and that sort of thing. Were you present at all for...
No.
No, not at all.
No.
Oh, okay. Bummer.
Ron didn't want me there.
Oh, okay. No. Oh, that's a shame. I was hoping to hear maybe some interesting.
You know, I got to say hello, but I wasn't like hanging, you know.
Oh, okay. Right. So you didn't get to mingle. But no, but it's a wonderful film, and the '80s were like sort of like a golden age, a peak period for these kinds of movies, these very high concept and original movies. You know, do you think that it was there was at the time that Hollywood was a little bit more was braver to take a risk more so than now?
I mean, I think for the major, I mean, I think that in the independent realm, people are taking much greater risks than that. But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of movies that, but in terms of mainstream movies in the Hollywood studios or wherever the studios are owned by now, they don't make those kind of movies. That movie was considered a sleeper. You know, it was like, it was a low budget, a very low budget movie for the studio. It was a $20 million
movie. Wow, yeah.
Which at that time was, you know, it was just that was the lowest budget movie they'd make. I don't think they'd ever made it. Maybe they'd pick things up that cost less, but they wouldn't make a movie for less than that. And so it was a sleeper for them. And so, you know, they didn't know if it was going to be something that never got released or got released in a very limited way. You know, so they did it, and we were able to get the, you know, it didn't have elaborate special effects.
Right.
It didn't have like a top heavy star in it. You know, it had big names, but it didn't have like, you know, somebody who was like, you know, would take over the show in some way. So it was, but yeah, it was in that category, you know, and it just really did great, you know, it got great word of mouth, it just did great,
yeah.
You know.
And
I think that at the time they were, you know, they were making smaller movies. They were making a number of movies like that every year at each of the studios, you know, a small number. So,
yeah.
You know, you add up a small number of five or six studios, and that's, you know, that's an interesting movie that they're getting made.
Yeah, totally. But Ron Howard, you know, eventually came on as director. Did so this must have been when Bob Zemeckis went off to do Romancing the Stone. Like, when did he depart and you were left with Ron Howard?
Yeah, well, he was supposed to do, they greenlit Cocoon, and then we had like all these special effects that had to be designed, and you know, there was like a lot of, you know, pre-production work, and then he got Romancing the Stone, and it was the same studio, it was 20th Century Fox.
Right.
And so he went off to do Romancing the Stone, and then he was going to do Cocoon afterward. And we went down to Mexico. I went down to Mexico with the Xanax and David Brown and Ralph McQuarrie, the conceptual artist.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Guy who did all the Star Wars stuff. He was on board. I was working with him on, you know, sketches for the, you know, for all special effects. And, you know, because we had an office and I was working on the script. And so we went down there to meet with Bob in Santa Cruz, Mexico, where they were shooting that movie.
Right.
And, you know, so it was kind of ongoing. And then he got into a huge fight with Fox on that movie. They were really hard on him. You know, they just thought that they didn't, it was kind of meddlesome with him the whole way. And he wasn't used to it. I don't know the exact story, but he had a hard time with them. And, they ended up, you know, saying, you know, taking him off of Cocoon as some kind of, I don't know what happened, but he was, you know, that ended, you know. So then we didn't have a director. And by the way, it was insane because the thing with Bob and Roman and stuff, if you look at that movie, how could you not look at those dailies from that movie and not see that it was amazing?
Right.
There was just so much, you know, it was so rich. I mean, it was so incredibly rich. It was the way everything was shot.
Mm.
And, you know, so anyway, so they did that, and then we were like scrambling around, and the movie was greenlit. We needed a director, and we were like, had these lists of all the directors who, you know, were acceptable to the studio, and it was like 50 people who were like, you know, like the guy, you know, George Cosmatos, the guy who directed Rambo.
Right,
who
yep.
became a friend of mine, because I worked with him later. They offered it to him, you know, because he was a hot director at that time.
Okay.
They
yeah.
didn't really, you know, they offered it to I won't go through it. So they offered it to a lot of people. And then, you know, Ron Howard had, you know, just directed Splash, and I saw Splash, and, you know, I told Zanuck, you know, we should try and get Ron Howard. This would be perfect for him.
Right.
And so we went after Ron Howard, and he had read the script, and just because it was at the studio, he, you know, they, someone had given it to him, he liked it. So he was interested in it. So we had this meeting, you know, talking about it, you know, to just try to get him on board, you know, and because it, it, and he agreed to do it, which was magic, you know, so it was a great thing.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it was definitely a good, you know, I think a good thing in his career. I mean, because it was a continuation. I mean, because Splash was very much, like you said before, Cocoon has very much a fairy tale vibe to it. And Splash was very much a fairy tale like picture. So this was almost a continuation, sort of a spiritual sequel, if you will, you know, continuing the fairy tale you know, flavor, if you will. Don't you think?
Yeah. It was a really, you know, and sometimes you think, oh, that person will be perfect because they just did something that fits so perfectly, and a person might be, I don't want to do that anymore, I'm moving on to something else, I did that already. But this, you know, this really segued beautifully, you know, people, you know, it just, he really gave it a great touch, and he worked the characters, you know, he came from a tradition in TV of, you know, with storytelling in terms of, you know, in terms of character development, you know, on the shows he was on, just like sort of fundamentals of TV storytelling in a half hour, you know, and from Happy Days, and you know, he had learned that, so he was like, you know, okay, let's think about these characters, let's add this kind of humorous detail to the characters, and, you know, bring more out there, and that was really, you know, made the movie, you know, supercharged the movie in its own way.
Oh, totally. And I think that's the big difference of films then and films now, is, like, you talked about working a lot on the characters, and Ron was very interested in the characters. I think that, you know, if it's today that the characters, you know, they're important to a fault, but they always seem to be dwarfed, if you will, by the spectacle of the effects or the big set pieces or whatever. But Cocoon is really, the strength of Cocoon is in the characters, like the parallel stories of the retirees and the aliens. You know, one is as equally as intriguing as the other, and the characters, and their separate stories, like Hume Cronin's story and Wilford Brimley's story and Don Ameche's story and Jack Guilford's story. I mean, that could be, you know, on paper that could be overwhelming, but it is intricate, because you have to love these characters, you have to assimilate with these characters, because, I mean, we've all got grandparents, we've all had grandparents, and, you know, they were young once, and, you know, it's a great exploration of that whole, you know, the family dynamic, you know, you know, just because you're old doesn't mean you're over the hill, that kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I completely agree.
Yeah, I mean, it's very rich in that aspect. One of my favorite bits that I wanted to ask you about, whether it was you know, of your invention, something, you know, that survived all the drafts and whatever, was, I love the scene where they're coming back from the pool, and Wilford Brimley is the first, I think, to bring it up, that he has an erection. you know, he says, and Don Ameche goes, "You have a boner too?" I think it's such a great, like, moment. Like, you know, he's like, you know, and then they all go home, and for the first time in a long time, they romance their wives. I think it's it's, you know.
Yeah, that was that was one of the things that was fundamental to the joke. Yeah. I mean, that was important.
Yeah.
From the beginning of what I was doing, trying to bring that stuff through but yeah. not like kill people with it, you know.
No, no, no. Sort of but it's done. It's done very tastefully, and you know, because you know they're such great actors. They carry it off with a bit of, you know.
Yeah, they're very cool. They were very cool.
Yeah.
But,
you know, the whole thing was rounded off by some other wonderful collaborators. The late, great Donald Peterman, who shot, you know, among his credits, Star Trek IV, Point Break, yeah. the original Point Break, Men in Black. And, of course, the incomparable James Horner's score just added
James Horner did a great score for us.
Yeah.
He really did. He was great.
Yeah,
great.
It was really
the movie. You know?
Yeah, it was really the cherry on the sundae. The score kind of ties it all together at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's important.
It gives life to the it gives emotion to the, you know, to the images, you know. But an incredible movie. But so I mean, what do you think? Do you think, you know, do you think it would be something that, you know, if rebooted today, what do you think? Do you think it would be?
I'm just waiting.
You're waiting.
they should reboot it.
Yeah.
I'm older now. I wasn't of that generation when I wrote it. Now I'm kind of that generation.
Right.
Obviously, I have to be. But. Yeah, so I have a couple projects that I kick around that are like that project. And as far as a reboot, you know, I don't know. I think it's still about a fringe group of society, people in society. I don't know why they have to reboot it. In a way, it's good because, you know, I mean, reboots don't always, you know, it's kind of often they're not very good. You know, it's hard to reboot something.
Yeah.
What
do you think, if given the chance, what do you think you would do differently? Do you think you'd do anything drastically different, or, you know?
I think not. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously the special effects, and, you know, there are things that would be advanced into a more distant future than they are where they are now, in terms of how they're done or what the style is.
Right.
But, you know, I think that testing, if you take that same premise of testing a group of people with this phenomenon, and, you know, saying, okay, what would happen if extraterrestrials landed next door and they had this magical ability, and we were able to partake of this magical ability.
Mm.
That, you know, how would it be for people now? You know,
right.
What kind of heart? You know, I think, okay, getting more specific, I think people would, you know, be a little edgier,
right.
The kinds of choices people would make,
right,
the
right.
reasons people, you know, the Jack Gilford situation, you
right.
know, why is he staying behind, you know, what kinds of, you know, I think we're more sophisticated about what people face before they go away, you know,
right.
what the last things that people are dealing with. So I think, you know, there's a little more grit and there's more depth that you could go into. So the tests of the characters
right.
under those kinds of circumstances could be
yeah.
more interesting. And I think, you know, there's always, you know, in terms of like suspense elements or, you know, the whether they could escape efforts, you know, I think finding ways to just, you know,
yeah.
make that more intense.
Right.
You know, so that it's, you know, it's compelling now.
Yeah. Well, certainly the scenes where, you know, it's revealed that they are aliens would probably be a lot more artful. I mean, with effects today, you know, because they really were, like, it wasn't really, like, they weren't aliens that were, like, sort of tech-heavy. I mean, their powers seemed to be more ethereal than technology-based, you know? So it'd be interesting, but so you weren't asked to come back for the sequel, The Return.
No, I was writing another script.
All right.
For Zanuck and Brown.
Right.
And the studio put them on some timeline.
Right.
And so I wasn't there
But would you have?
It was sort of like a double-edged sword, you know. Right. I felt bad. Oh, why can't I do the sequel? But then the sequel came out and it wasn't very good.
Yeah.
And they were forced to kind of repeat the story of the original rather than tell a second, you know, follow the story out to outer space.
Right.
Which kind of made it not that satisfying. You know?
Right.
They needed to go to outer space to, you know, see what was going to happen to them next.
Right. Sure. But given the opportunity, you think you would have, if they had have asked you, done the sequel?
Yeah, I would have had to. You know, I was working with them. I was really involved with them. I think.
Right.
I would have had to do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would.
So you don't.
I don't know if they would have. They wouldn't have done it. You know, if the studio had insisted that we going back to Return to Earth, I think I would have tried to fight them on it. You know?
Right. Yeah.
Tried to do it different.
Yeah.
Something more ambitious.
Yeah, because I mean, I think sometimes it's a bit of a, you know, when they always come back to the same place, it's a bit of a.
Sometimes
it's a bit too easy, isn't it? You know? It's a bit too easy.
Toy Story 2, the Toy Story movies, that's a great job they've done with their sequels.
Yeah.
You know, the guy who did the special effects for Cocoon, Greg Canham, he won the Oscar this year for Vice.
Yes.
You know, he's like one of the deans of special makeup effects
in
Hollywood.
Yes. Yeah, totally. That's wonderful. And equally as wonderful it's been to talk to you, Tom, mate. I've long wanted to talk to someone associated with the movie because it has a special place in my heart. It's a wonderful film. I think it's
well, thank you. Yeah. I really appreciate it. It's been great speaking with you. It's fun for me to recollect a little bit talk about the movie. I haven't done it in a while.
Yeah, it's been fantastic, and in my heart of hearts, I hope that they leave it alone. I really wish they would leave the classics alone. but you know, whenever there's a chance to make money, it's you know.
Yeah, there's no business like show business. We hope for the best, you know.
Yeah.
And we hope that's gonna, if they do it, then it's going to be great. So we'll see what happens.
Well, it's my hope that if they do decide to do it, they give you a call. And listen to your ideas.
I agree. Yeah, they should hire me to do it. Of course.
Totally. Yeah. Because I've no doubt that you probably had a lot of ideas that probably got thrown in the trash bin at some point because it was either too expensive or scheduling wise not viable to do and all that sort of thing. Was there a lot of stuff that didn't make the grade, as far as in the script writing, I mean.
Like Cocoon, you mean?
Yeah, like did a lot of they say, well, okay, no, that.
There were other ideas. Yeah, there were other ideas. I mean, there was a first draft of the story, and it was when I pitched it to the Zanuck, the story they wanted to do it, but they had like they wanted the story reworked, so I went back and worked on the story and came back to them, and we pitched it to them with adjustments to the story, and then they said, yeah, let's do it. And they went to the studio and said, we want to write the script and write a script for this. So yeah, and then in that script, there were things that I couldn't. I would have to go back to my notes, to my boxes of scripts to find the stuff that was cut out.
That's cool. That'd be an interesting. That'd be an interesting thing for a retrospective.
I'm gonna read the first draft tomorrow.
Yeah. That's cool.
I'm gonna make myself do that.
That's great. I mean, that'd be interesting for a retrospective. For an anniversary, like to go through it and have a look at what could have been and what did happen. But I mean, not that what did happen was bad. What happened was wonderful. But you know, there's always that, you know, ooh, what might have been sort of thing. But, But anyway, Tom, mate, look, I've taken up way too much of your time. Thank you very much for talking to me. I hope sincerely that if Hollywood does have an inkling to do another Cocoon or a reboot or a reimagination or whatever they want to call it, I hope that one of the first people they get in contact with is the man himself, Tom Benedict. He's been my guest today. Cocoon, a wonderful film. If you haven't watched it in a while, go and check it out again. If you've never seen it, please, please do. It's a wonderful movie. As my guest,
all right.
Tom Benedict, thank you, mate. Have a wonderful...
Thank you. Wonderful... Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it. It's great speaking with you.
Take it easy, sir. Thank you again. All right.